Hi, it's Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane, and it's great to be with you. On my mind, this week, Pope Francis marks his fifth year as head of the Roman Catholic Church. His impact has been huge and controversial. I talked to New York Times columnist Ross Douthat about just how far the Pope can go in his efforts to liberalize the Church.
He's focused intensely on figuring out a way to, in effect, reconcile the Church with the way that Western people live now.
Then, the diversity visa lottery has become one of President Trump's favorite punching bags when it comes to immigration policy. I clear up fact from fiction and get a firsthand account from a lottery winner.
I'm not very sure whether the day of my wedding or the day I realized that I'm one of the green card lottery winners was the bigger one for me. I think it was the second.
But first, 5 years ago this week, Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, was elected Pope. He chose to be called Pope Francis in honor of St. Francis of Assisi. He's the first Jesuit Pope, the first Pope from the Americas, the first Pope, in fact, from anywhere outside Europe in 13 centuries. And one of the voices weighing in on the Francis papacy is Ross Douthat. You know him as a regular columnist for the New York Times, and he has a new book, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. He joins me via Skype. Ross, welcome to On My Mind.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, your book doesn't go on sale for another couple of weeks, so appreciate you coming on early to talk about it. We won't tell your publisher that you're actually jumping the gun here.
Well, you can pre-order it now on Amazon.com, and they all count.
Yeah, they sure do. You know, before we get into your assessment of Pope Francis, which is what you write about in this book, let's talk a bit about your own faith journey. In the Times, you write about many issues. You're also a film critic for the National Review. But you write early in your book, Ross, that your identity as a Catholic became important to your writing. How so?
I'm neither a cradle Catholic nor an adult convert. I'm that little known third category of people who became Catholics as teenagers. My mother and father were Episcopalian when I was a kid. And then beginning probably when I was about 6 or 7 years old, we went on a kind of religious pilgrimage through American Christianity, mostly under the impetus of my mother. And so we were evangelicals and Pentecostalists, and I watched my parents speak in tongues and all manner of strange things. And then we ended up sort of coming to rest, as it were, within Roman Catholicism. So I have sort of a mixture when it comes to being Catholic of some cradle Catholic experiences, but also the experience of making sort of a definitive convert's choice. And I found as a journalist that background, not only the Catholicism, but the general religious experience has been tremendously helpful to me, actually, in sort of shaping my work and analysis and coverage. As you probably know well, journalism tends to be a fairly secular profession. And I think that having a kind of distinctive background within a kind of religious quest, as I did as a kid, has given me kind of a wider angle on the diversity and strangeness of the religious world.
Well, I'm sure you know, Ross, that the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, famously said after the election of Donald Trump that he thought one of the problems was that the mainstream media does not get religion. Sounds like you would agree with that.
Yeah, I think that there's sort of two natural tensions between the press and religion. One is a sort of class and cultural dynamic, where as journalism has become much more professionalized and, you know, elite journalism especially has become sort of crowded with people who go to elite colleges and elite universities, you get a sort of natural sort of skepticism about religion that's just sort of connected to the general skepticism about religion within the American intelligentsia writ large. And then you also have the fact that, you know, journalists are by their nature debunkers. And there's always a sort of suspicion for a journalist, I think, a natural suspicion covering any religious institution about whether people really believe this stuff, right? So it's sort of very easy for journalists to cover religious institutions in terms of political battles with, you know, liberal factions versus conservative factions and so on. But when you get down to the strangeness of doctrine and dogma, I think the natural impulse of the journalist is always to say, well, come on, there must be something else going on here. You're telling me about a virgin birth and a resurrection, but surely somebody's, pulling the wool over my eyes somewhere here or something.
Yeah, for all those reasons, I would think it'd be easier for a somewhat secular-minded journalist, if he's or she is going to be affiliated with a church, to join one of the, more liberal, progressive denominations like Episcopalianism or Lutheranism or the Methodists. You chose, and partly under the influence of your mother, but not entirely, you chose Catholicism.
I did, and I did so because I thought it was true, or I thought it was the most likely to be true. I suppose that, I'm not a mystical personality like my mother was. I didn't have the kind of sort of direct experiences of the divine that she had when I was a kid that sort of shaped her life and mine. I have a more somewhat sort of skeptical and reason-oriented personality. And so I'm not sure where my religious pilgrimage would have ended up if it had just been undertaken on my own. But I thought that Catholicism had the best claim to represent the church founded by Jesus of Nazareth. And I thought that the story of Jesus of Nazareth was the most compelling reason for human beings to believe that there is a God who is not just sort of an impersonal force or a pantheistic spirit, but a personality who actually cares about our individual fates. And so that combination of Christian belief and then belief in sort of Catholicism's claims to continuity and fidelity to the message of Jesus were what made me a Catholic and what I guess have kept me a Catholic along with habit down to the present day.
And now that you are a committed Catholic, you have a stake, you have an investment, it seems, in the future of the Catholic Church and the strength of the Catholic Church. And it's a concern around that investment that seems to be at the heart of your book.
Yeah, so Pope Francis was elected by cardinals who saw him, I think, primarily as a potential reformer for the Vatican itself. There was a sense that the Vatican was sort of run like a Renaissance court, that it was filled with sort of self-serving ecclesiastical functionaries who had undermined the previous pontificate of Benedict XVI, and Francis was brought in to, in effect, clean things up. And what's been fascinating about his pontificate is that he has been incredibly energetic and vigorous in seeking changes within Catholicism. But the changes he's sought have not really been a kind of, ecclesiastical reform. There have been sort of plans undertaken and blueprints drawn up for changing how the Vatican works. But very little of that has made much progress or gone very far forward. And instead, Francis has focused on he's focused on a lot of things, but he's focused intensely on figuring out a way to, in effect, reconcile the church with the way that Western people live now, which has meant, in particular, seeking a way to sort of ease the tension between church teaching on marriage and sexuality and sort of the state of Western culture 50 years after the sexual revolution. And so this has come to a very sharp point in the debate about divorce and remarriage and communion, where Pope Francis convened two synods on the family, where he brought together bishops from all over the world, in effect, in an attempt to get a kind of cover for changing the church's rules about communion for the remarried. Because right now, if you're a remarried Catholic, you're only supposed to take communion if you have obtained from the church a declaration that your first marriage is null, which is to say that it wasn't a real marriage at all. And if you haven't, that means that your first marriage is still your real marriage and your second marriage is considered adulterous. And if you're in a state of adultery, you aren't supposed to take communion. It's in effect a kind of sacrilege. And this is a point that has been part of church teaching for hundreds or even thousands of years. It was very explicitly reiterated by the last two popes. And Francis very clearly, I think, would like it to change. And that change has been resisted by bishops. It's been criticized by people, including newspaper columnists, by myself. And what has ended up happening is that, in effect, Francis has moved the church to a kind of ambiguous position, where he says, well, there's a distinction between the doctrinal issue of the indissolubility of marriage and pastoral realities, and that distinction should let specific dioceses, specific countries, experiment with different approaches. And of course, this in turn has all kinds of implications for all the other vexed, controversial issues facing the church around the sexual revolution, because if you can have this sort of pastoral case-by-case approach to divorce and remarriage, there's no obvious reason why you wouldn't have it towards, say, blessings for same-sex unions or acceptance of physician-assisted suicide and so on. These are the issues that journalists are always sort of fascinated by with the church, because they're the point of sort of sharpest tension between the church and the culture that we all inhabit. And Francis has very clearly, in ways that I think a lot of people didn't think were possible, sought a kind of truce, but also prompted a lot of controversy about whether this, what he's seeking, is actually possible for the church to do.
So, Russ, as you say, the resistance is coming from bishops. Pope Francis, in your own words, has tried to reconcile the church with the way people live now. And I think it's fair to say that if there is a division in the church, it's often one place we see it is between the bishops and the laity, between the bishops and the people, the Catholics who are living their lives. And Pope Francis seems to be trying to reorient the church to, as you say, the way people live now. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it is that sometimes the way people are living is not, in fact, the way that Christian morality intend and God himself intends for them to live. And one of the things that has, again, at least to me, always been impressive about Catholicism is that it has maintained a commitment to a lot of the hardest things that show up if you actually go back and read the New Testament. You know, the New Testament is a very strange set of documents. It features a protagonist, Jesus, who makes a lot of extreme claims and offers a lot of very extreme moral exhortations. And so, for instance, you know, there's a moment in the New Testament where Jesus says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't have life hereafter. And the Gospels themselves say, well, people were freaked out by that and left. And Catholicism, in its teaching on communion, on the Eucharist, has always said, well, Jesus meant it, right? And we believe in transubstantiation. We believe in this radical, impossible-seeming thing. And the same is true in certain ways of issues around celibacy and poverty and a lot of elements of the New Testament. And one of those is marriage. Jesus is explicitly asked by the Pharisees about the kind of questions that we're wrestling with in the Western world today. And the Pharisees in the gospel narratives are the ones who are saying, well, look, you know, God has to make some kind of allowance for divorce in all these kinds of ways. And Jesus is the one saying, no, in the beginning, God made the male and female. And if you, and what God has joined together, let not man separate. So for the church can go a certain distance in accommodating itself. And in fact, it has, and certainly, especially in the United States, it has basically already changed the rules around annulment, so that instead of just saying you can only get an annulment if, you know, you were forced to marry someone against your will, or if it was, you know, it was a sibling and you didn't know it or something like that, the annulment procedure now takes into account issues of emotional maturity and, you know, a whole range of psychological factors that make it much easier to obtain an annulment than it was, say, in 1947. And that kind of compromise is compatible. It stretches things a bit, but it's compatible with the idea that marriage is a real and indissoluble thing. What Francis has pushed for, it seems to me, is much more of just a full evacuation of the teaching, where somewhere in a book in the Vatican, it says, well, marriage is indissoluble. But in practice, if you go, you know, if you have a situation where people don't even need to get an annulment to take communion, then the teaching has no practical implications. It's just a sort of nod to an ideal that isn't practical in reality. And again, this is not how Catholicism has traditionally approached these kind of questions. And for it to change that approach, obviously, people think it may be necessary. It would be an enormous deal. It would be a shift that would be remembered and argued over for hundreds of years in the future, which is why in the book, I spend a lot of time just talking about the historical significance of this controversy, whatever side you come down on, ultimately.
You call it a hinge moment or a breaking moment. A hinge moment, that's an intriguing term in the history of Catholicism. But Given that the laity, that the Catholic laity seems to feel comfortable with this more flexibility when it comes to issues of divorce and remarriage, how do we not know that if Pope Francis had followed a harder line like his predecessors, that we would still be at a hinge moment or a breaking point, you know, with the laity, the Catholic, you know, normal Catholics sort of rising up in protest against the doctrinal dogma of the bishops and the Pope?
No, I mean, I think it's fair to say that what Francis has done is sort of bring to a sharp point this tension that's existed really since the Cultural Revolution to the 1960s. So any pope who, you know, any pope who did anything would have to deal with the reality that lots of the laity in the West and everywhere around the world ignore church teaching or practice it partially and so on. That's just sort of a fact of Catholic life. At the same time, it's not necessarily true that sort of all of the laity are on Pope Francis's side and agree with the changes and so on. What you actually see is that in polls, you know, the Catholics who are most likely to think that, you know, changing church teaching is necessary and important are also those who've already drifted from the church, who are lapsed and non-practicing or Christmas and Easter Catholics and so on. And then if you look at Catholics who are actually practicing, you have a kind of persistent 50-50, 40-60, 60-40 divide on a lot of these questions. So how divided the laity is and where the laity comes down varies with the country you look at, the practice of the Catholics and so on. And then it also varies geographically, right? The Catholicism is a global communion. And what Francis is doing is pursuing reforms that are seen as absolutely essential and necessary by, for instance, a lot of leaders of the German Catholic Church, but that are opposed and resisted by a lot of leaders of the African Catholic Church or the Polish Catholic Church. And so there's a sense in which he's pushing a lot of chips onto the idea that Western society right now is just the model for the future, and every other society is going to converge on where we've ended up, when in fact I don't think it's entirely clear that where we've ended up is a necessarily stable resting point, as certain sort of instabilities in the West right now might suggest.
Well, as you point out in your book, the Anglican Communion has split along these very lines, and in fact the more conservative segments of the Anglican world seem to be on the ascendancy, while the more liberal ones are seeing their membership threatened. Is that the future that you fear for Catholicism?
I do think that a lot of Catholics on both sides of this debate underestimate the risk of real sort of schism and division. I think the moves Pope Francis have made, because he's chosen this kind of ambiguous permission slip rather than any kind of informal change of teaching, mean that you're not going to have some sort of breaking point in his pontificate, most likely. What's more likely, I think, is that you'll have a kind of persistent evolution of different national churches and different regions in the Catholic world away from one another over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, assuming that this sort of this more decentralized vision of the church persists. And then at some point, that evolution away will lead to something like you've seen in Anglicanism, where the differences between the different churches within countries and across countries become so significant that it becomes very hard and unreasonable, in fact, to hold the whole thing together. So ultimately, I think this is going towards something that ironically liberal Catholics have been calling for a couple of generations, which is to say some sort of third Vatican Council, some sort of new ecumenical council that sort of tries to settle and resolve for all time some of these questions. And for a long time, conservative Catholics, probably including myself, said, oh, that's silly. You know, John Paul II has interpreted Vatican II, and that's all that we really need. But I think that the Francis era has demonstrated that John Paul II sort of covered over a lot of divisions that just sort of persisted. And the reality is that, you know, that there needs to be a larger resolution to these problems than just having this pope or that pope take a stand on them.
Okay, so these divisions are around, as you say, certain theological issues, whether divorced people should be able to take communion after they remarry, the church's position on same-sex marriage, whether women have a role, what kind of role women should have in the church. One of the questions that I have for you, Ross, is whether your critique of Pope Francis around these issues reflects your own theological beliefs about these issues, or does it reflect a more strategic view in terms of what you think is the best route for the church to take in order to survive and flourish in the years ahead?
I think it's a little of both. I think that there is a fair amount of evidence that sort of attempts to just sort of liberalize Christian churches and bring them completely in tune with the sexual revolution in various ways and modernity writ large have not worked out that well. And the examples of much of mainline Protestantism, not only the Episcopal Church, but other churches in the Western world, suggest that there isn't some magic, sort of magic sociological lever that you can hit where you say, okay, you know, now the church is going to be liberal and suddenly everybody's going to come back. People have been leaving Christian churches in the West for a host of reasons, of which these sort of sexual and moral issues are just sort of proximate causes. So in that sense, I do think there's a kind of sociological case for the conservative position, but that case is limited, right? It's, as you say, it's sort of strategic and pragmatic, and you know, you could see sociological data that would cause you to revise it. And in fact, you know, there are liberalizing steps that Francis could take that I would be skeptical of that I don't think would, you know, would raise sort of major doctrinal issues. For instance, there's talk of, you know, allowing married priests in certain areas, particularly the Amazon region in Latin America, where there are hardly any priests. And you could imagine the church allowing married priests sort of across the board in the Western world. I think that would be a mistake in various ways, but it wouldn't provoke the same kind of potential theological crisis that some of the stuff around divorce and remarriage has provoked, because there's a general agreement that the Pope has the power to allow priests to marry or not. And whereas the whole debate in this question is really over what is the Pope allowed to do, right? Is the Pope allowed to say that marriages that the church considers indissoluble are actually soluble? And the conservative side thinks, based on sort of its vision of the church, that is sort of, in fact, the traditional vision, that the Pope can't do that, that the Pope, for all that he supposedly has these absolute powers, is in fact deeply constrained. And much of the drama of the Francis era is the drama of a Pope sort of trying to shake free of these constraints on his own power in order to effect these changes.
So just to take one issue, Ross, the role of women in the church. Do you defend the idea that women should not be ordained in the Catholic Church? And if so, why not?
I would defend the idea that women should not be ordained as priests. Yes, I'm agnostic, I guess, on the question of whether they should be ordained as deacons, which is another issue that Francis has sort of reopened for debate. I think there's a certain amount of evidence from church history that women have been ordained to the diaconate in the past, and there's a difference between the purpose of the diaconate and the purpose of the priesthood. The issue with the priesthood is that the central purpose of the priest is to act in persona Christi, in the person of Christ, in the Mass. And the church has always held that because Jesus is male, that the priest, in order to act fully in Christ's person, it has to be male as well. But the question, I think, is whether that's compatible with a wider role for women, whether through the diaconate or in some other way in church governance. In fact, you know, you could argue that there isn't a good reason why you couldn't have a female cardinal, for instance, because cardinals, while they are all priests now, have not always been priests in the past, and it is a governance role rather than a sacramental role. And more generally, I think, you know, Pope Francis has made a few high-profile female appointments, but the fact that there hasn't been a major reorganization of the Vatican's bureaucracy, as was promoted and proposed at the outset of this pontificate, has meant that there hasn't actually been as much room as there could have been for creating more offices led by lay people and particularly by lay women, or even offices run by sisters and nuns. And I think that there was and remains lots of room for Pope Francis or a future pope to expand the role of women in running the church from Rome in ways that would not lead to any kind of sort of necessarily theological controversy in the way that opening a debate about ordaining women to the priesthood would.
Yeah. So another big issue, Ross, is birth control. And this year, of course, is the 50th anniversary of that famous papal encyclical Humanae Vitae, where Rome made clear that the church was still opposed to contraception, artificial contraception. And boy, what are the statistics now on how many American Catholics at least abide by that church teaching?
Low. Earlier I was saying that on many of these sort of controversial teachings, you'll get a 50-50 split among frequent churchgoers. But with contraception, it's much more like 80-20 or even 90-10, depending on what the polls look like. And, you know, there's some evidence that you have Catholic women or Catholic couples who will use natural family planning at times and sort of move in and out and so on. I mean, the picture on the ground is always more complicated than the sound bites, but it's certainly a teaching that is practiced by a minority and often a very small minority of Catholics.
And what's the lesson of that, Ross? I mean, is the lesson that the church can't get too divorced from the way Catholics actually live without losing its authority or its credibility? Or is there another lesson to be drawn from that?
I mean, that could be one lesson. I think you'll have conservatives who will argue that, you know, that in fact, if the church had stood up more firmly for the teaching, if it hadn't sort of shrugged and avoided talking about it because it was too intimate and strange seeming, that you could have actually had the numbers look different, that you would have had more Catholic couples, as you did before Vatican II, practicing natural family planning, not using artificial birth control. I'm not sure that's true. I actually think one lesson might be that sometimes a teaching just has to become a kind of extremely countercultural idea, especially when there's a social and technological, in this case, revolution ongoing. And you have to wait a while to see how that revolution develops and what comes of it before you figure out exactly what the best church response is. And I should say, I say this as someone for whom the teaching on contraception as a Catholic, you know, myself, it's a harder to grasp teaching in certain ways than the teaching on divorce and remarriage that's been such a point of vexation in this pontificate. It's more abstract, more of a focus on sort of abstract points of natural law. And personally, I don't find it surprising that unlike church teachings on, say, abortion, you have even a minority of conservative Catholics who don't follow it. But at the same time, you know, the development of social life in the West since the 1960s has vindicated a lot of predictions that Pope Paul VI made in that encyclical, Humanae Vitae. If you go back and read his predictions about what a kind of contraceptive culture would mean for family and marriage and relations between the sexes and so on, you know, in our era of Me Too, a lot of it seems very familiar. And you have sort of fascinating trends where among sort of secular, holistically minded, upper middle class women, there's all this interest in fertility apps that let you go off the pill and so on. Even as, you know, we're sort of going further towards a kind of contraceptive view in the sort of injectable birth controls and hormones and so on that we're pushing on the lower and working classes. So there's a sense in which I think a lot of these trends just probably need to play out further before we figure out exactly what the church should be doing to make that teaching plausible in the modern world.
You said something interesting there, Ross. You said that the church maybe sometimes needs to be countercultural. Why is that an important role for the church or an important idea for the church to advance?
Well, because if, again, for the church's message to make sense, it has to be, in effect, Jesus's message. And one of the points that's often made against more conservative Catholics is that Jesus himself was a countercultural figure. And to the extent that the church is just seen as sort of enmeshed with the power structures of the age and as sort of, you know, a vehicle for maintaining bourgeois middle class morality or something. To that extent, then the church probably isn't following Jesus very closely. And this is, you know, this is something that, again, it's a case where in certain ways Francis has been very impressive and eloquent and vivid in trying to propose the church as a countercultural force, to say, look, you know, we have to be on the side of the prisoner and the refugee and the migrant, and above all, we need to be a church for the poor, and not just to be sort of locked away in our beautiful cathedrals and so on. But where I suppose, again, the point of disagreement lies is that it seems to me that sort of essentially emptying out some of the church's hard teachings on sexuality are a way of becoming worldly, as much as being rich and powerful, saying that, you know, we're just sort of going along with whatever the ambient sexual culture is doing is itself a kind of worldliness, I think.
So as someone who cares very much about the future of the Catholic Church, what is your greatest fear right now with respect to the papacy of Pope Francis?
I mean, I think that he is potentially setting in motion a process that will make the unity of the church harder and harder to maintain. That the model that he's following to deal with these vexing and controversial questions essentially ends up devolving more and more authority to national and local churches, which then in turn sort of go along with whatever the cultural situation is there. So the African churches will be more conservative and the German church will be extremely liberal and the American church will fight amongst itself, as American Catholics have been doing for a long time. And that kind of development, it seems to me, makes the unity of the church harder and harder to maintain. And what we've seen in Protestant denominations, in global Anglicanism, among United Methodists and many other Protestant churches, is that without a sort of central force for doctrinal unity, the tendency is to simply develop away from one another to a point where real unity becomes impossible, because you have different views, not just about, you know, the use of artificial contraception, but about the nature of scriptural authority, who Jesus really is, these questions that are sort of lurking below the surface in all of these culture war controversies, but are connected to them. And again, the more churches develop in different directions, the harder it becomes for them to agree, not just about divorce and remarriage, but about what we mean when we say that Jesus Christ is the Son of God.
So, Rostatha, the number one religion story, it seems to me, over the last year or so, has been about evangelicals and their support for President Trump. There's a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of stories written about wither evangelicalism. And you have come out with a book, To Change the Church, The Future of Catholicism. Is that, in your judgment, the story, the religion story that we should be following most closely right now?
Well, I mean, as a believing Catholic, of course, I think that the fate of the Catholic Church is ultimately the most important story in the world, not just the most important religious story, the most important story, period. But that's admittedly a prejudiced view. I think the argument that I would make, though, is that even if you are not a Catholic, even if you are a non-believer who just takes an interest in religion, what's happening in Catholicism right now, this question of how much a reforming and liberalizing pope can change this billion-member church to adapt to current trends in Western modernity, that question is going to have huge implications for every religion going forward across the next decades and even across centuries. And I think that, yeah, you can make a stronger case that from a global perspective especially, that's a bigger story than the particular tensions and corruptions within American evangelicalism right now. Although I would, that is also an important story. I'd also add that, you know, in certain ways, there are interesting similarities between Donald Trump and Pope Francis. They are obviously men with very different visions, very different moral values, but they are also both figures who are sort of populist figures who have taken power within institutions that are seen as sort of out of touch and corrupt. And, you know, Make America Great Again is a slogan of renewal in its own way. And much of what Francis has done around church doctrine and the way, you know, is similar, again, in a sort of mirror, cracked mirror kind of way, to a lot of the bull in the china shop behavior that you've had from the Trump administration in Washington. So they are both in certain ways representative figures of an era in which Western institutions have lost a lot of credibility, and there's room for, you know, charismatic would-be reformers to take power and have interesting things happen afterward.
Well, you're well known as not a big fan of Donald Trump, and I think you've made clear in this interview that you got some problems with Pope Francis as well. Are you saying that there is a kind of a danger to the populist impulse, you know, that we need to keep in mind?
I think there's obviously a danger, but I also, since I am making this critical case, I want to also stress that populist figures don't come out of nowhere. And just as many of the things that drove people to vote for Donald Trump were real problems and real failures on the part of the American elite, so it would be silly to ignore the fact all the ways in which, you know, institutional Catholicism had lost credibility. That it all the ways in which the church needed a reform-minded figure like Francis, and all the ways in which early in his pontificate, at least, you could make the case that, you know, he was doing much more good than harm in sort of changing the image of Catholicism through his sort of his vivid public gestures. So the fact, I think, in where Francis has ended up, this desire for change that has led the church into a kind of theological crisis, there you can certainly see the dangers of having a populist as pope. But at the same time, you know, what Francis's admirers would say that's true is that, you know, the synthesis that John Paul II and others tried to create had flaws in it. It was, as we've talked about, sort of rejected by many practicing Catholics. And something like the sex abuse crisis sort of loomed large as an example of, independent of doctrinal issues, why the institutional church could not be trusted for a lot of people. So, yeah, so I have a lot of doubts about where Francis is taking the church. But as with Donald Trump, the institutional problems that led to his ascent shouldn't be ignored or dismissed.
Well, here we are in the fifth anniversary of the papacy of Francis, and your book, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism, is coming out at a really important time. Once again, Raoul Stothet, thanks for giving us a kind of a sneak preview peek of your book. I'm sure you're going to have a lot to say in the coming weeks as this conversation continues.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Now, a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And we're back. When it comes to immigration policy these days, President Trump has been sounding off on the diversity visa lottery. He wants to get rid of the program. But some of the things he has said about the program are just plain wrong. We invited two women to join us in the studio, both experts on the diversity visa program in their own way. Julia Galat is senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, and Clara Bilgeen is dean of the School of Public and International Affairs at Virginia International University. And she herself was a recipient of a diversity visa. She won the lottery. So welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
President Trump has made the diversity visa a big issue. And in a conversation with Jeanine Pirro of Fox News last month, he had this to say about the program.
I mean, we actually have lottery systems where you go to countries and they do lotteries for who comes into the United States. Now, you know they're not going to have their best people in a lottery because they're not going to put their best people in a lottery. They don't want to have their good people leave. So we get
they don't want to have their good people leave. He is saying, Julia, that these countries that are able to send immigrants to the United States through the visa lottery program choose who goes into that lottery. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. So the way that the program works is that individuals from eligible countries apply to be part of the diversity lottery. And then the United States actually conducts the lottery. The State Department has a computerized lottery system. They pick a number of names for those 50,000 visas that are available. So it's the individuals who apply, and then it's the United States who runs the lottery. And the idea of the lottery is just that there are more people who apply every year than who can get a green card. So the lottery, I believe, was seen as a fair way to allocate a scarce resource.
So just to get the facts straight, what role, if any, does a government, a foreign government, have in choosing who goes into the lottery, who leaves that country as a beneficiary of this program?
So the foreign country has absolutely no role. It's up to the individuals abroad to apply. And the government has no right to say, you can apply, you can't apply. It's really up to the U.S. government.
Well, which people are eligible to apply to the program?
So it's people from countries that have sent fewer immigrants to the United States. If a country has sent fewer than 50,000 immigrants over the past 5 years, then nationals from that country can apply for the diversity visa.
And in order to apply for a diversity visa, do you have to meet any particular criteria?
So you have to show that you have a high school diploma or the local equivalent, or you can qualify by having 2 years of work experience in basically a middle skill type of job.
And how many people apply for, how many people throw their names into this lottery each year?
So last year when it was conducted, almost 15 million applied. And again, that's for just 50,000 green cards that they're competing for. So it's a pretty low chance of winning.
So these countries that are eligible to send immigrants to the United States through the under the visa lottery program are ones that were not well represented, have not been well represented in immigration to the United States. Is that the only reason for the introduction of this program? What do you know? What can you tell us about why this was enacted, when it was enacted?
The diversity visa program has kind of an interesting history. So when the country reformed our immigration laws in 1965, we put a really heavy emphasis on family sponsorship. That was the main way you can come to the United States, is if you have a close family member to sponsor you. So that left out countries that hadn't recently sent a lot of immigrants to the United States. One of those countries was Ireland, which had a strong Irish-American lobby in the United States. And with some economic troubles in Ireland in the 70s and 80s, a lot of Irish people wanted to come to the United States, but they didn't have those close relatives to sponsor them. So some were coming on temporary visas, visitor visas, and overstaying, becoming unauthorized immigrants. And they were pushing hard for a new channel so that they could come legally to the United States, or they could legalize their status within the United States. So that led in the 1980s to the creation of the first diversity visa program. And that program heavily benefited Irish nationals, but also helped people from other countries as well. And then our current diversity visa program was created in the 1990 immigration law.
So, Clara Bilgin, you were a recipient of a diversity visa. Tell us your story.
Yes, well, so in 1997, I came to the U.S. as a student in the University of Delaware in the Department of Political Science. And in the same year, I applied for the diversity visa lottery.
And Clara, excuse me, you're from Bulgaria.
Yes, yes. So in 1998, it was around May, I opened my mailbox and I found an official-looking letter from the from USCIS or whatever, the Department of State and the agency that was dealing with the immigrant visa lottery was at this time. And I didn't take it seriously. I thought that it was an amazing practical joke made by one of my classmates, because they knew how much I wanted to be one of the winners. But luckily, I basically checked with the system and I found out that this would be the case, that this was true. So it really opened up a lot of possibilities for me. I was here already for a master's level program, but I knew that after that I would either have to, you know, go back or continue in some other way. By receiving the green card in this way, it opened up a number of possibilities for me, and I ended up going through a PhD process. But it also made me very much interested about the experience of applying and receiving a green card lottery around the world.
So let's go back to that day that you realized that you actually had won a diversity visa. Tell us about that day.
I'm not very sure whether my the day of my wedding or the day I realized that I'm one of the green card lottery winners was the bigger one for me. I think it was the second.
The day that you won a visa was bigger than your wedding.
I absolutely believe this to be the case. But I believe that it was bigger not only for me, but for my extended family. Because once you have a winner, it is really a process of extension. You win, you know that you have a path of citizenship in America, but then you basically share the joy with your family. So I believe that back in Bulgaria, the moment I called and gave the news, my mom and dad started celebrating. They ran to the neighbors ran to their neighbors, and by the end of the day, all our apartment block, one of these kind of old Khrushchev apartment blocks that you can imagine in Eastern Europe, one of them in Sofia, was buzzing with the news that their daughter had won the green card lottery.
You came here as a student, and you did not want to return to Bulgaria when you were here as a student?
Well, I am the generation, I would say I'm the last generation to be raised behind the Iron Curtain. And we were this generation that went through the process of economic reforms, political reforms, the revolutions of 1989. And frankly, growing up, I believed in freedom. I was sleeping late in my room in Sofia and listening to Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. So I was one of these members of a generation that was growing with the American ideal of democracy and freedom. So that's why I really wanted to.
And Julia, Clara has done very well. She's got a PhD. She is the dean of the School of Public and International Affairs at Virginia International University. She obviously is contributing a lot to this country. She brought skills and aptitude. She has a great story.
Yes.
Is there a profile of a diversity visa recipient?
So there aren't a lot of data in which you can distinguish who has a diversity visa, so what we know is a little bit limited. But there was a survey in 2003, the New Immigrant Survey, where we could see the educational attainment of people who were getting green cards through various channels. And those who were getting green cards as diversity visa holders, half of them, 50%, had a bachelor's or higher degree, compared to just 32% of Americans. So that's a pretty high level of educational attainment. So in that way, I would say the story, is typical. We also looked at this a different way to kind of update this story. We looked at the educational attainment of recent immigrants from countries that use the diversity visa program pretty heavily, and we found the same thing, that about half were coming with a bachelor's degree or higher.
So, Clara Bilgin, what is it that you think that immigrants in general, but in particular the applicants for the diversity visa lottery, what is it they have in common? What unites them, do you think?
This is what I think. From my recent observations in some places in Turkey and Armenia and Romania, I would speak with people and they would say, hey, there is no other way out for us. And I would speak with single mothers, people who are well-educated but may have an alternative lifestyle, such as, for example, being gay, or people who are educated but they are not in favor with the authorities. People who live in regimes where they just cannot make it. They don't have the right connections. They don't have enough wealth. They are not part of the structures of government. And most of these countries, they are oppressive. There is sometimes also lack of physical security. So these people, at some level, they see this as their only other alternative, as their single chance in life to change their fate. And that's why you would have them applying for 15, sometimes now 20 years. Any other program that is meritocratic, that other countries have, would be steered to those people who are well-educated, but most often they would be privileged, they would be well-connected, they would be the global elite. Yes, every country wants to get the global elite. Well, the specific thing about this program, and I frankly happen to think that it's ingenious, but the thing that makes it ingenious and so American is exactly that it is universal. That it doesn't care so much whether you are the crop of the crop, and that it accepts that there is human value in everyone. And people around the world understand that. And they kind of value the fact that I may not be a professor, but I also have the same chance of applying and possibly winning as one of the top professors in the country. So the symbolic power of this program abroad is huge.
Okay, Julia, is there any reason why, you know, a more of a merit-based program wouldn't have that same sort of character to it, you know, that it would still generate the same level of interest and excitement and motivation?
As Clara was explaining, the Diversity Visa program has a wide reach because, you know, as long as you have that high school diploma or that relevant work experience, almost anybody in the world, except, you know, in those countries that send a lot of immigrants, can dream of coming to the United States. Our employment-based system has pretty high requirements in terms of education and skills. And so if you're someone who has a lot of motivation but maybe didn't have the opportunities in life to pursue your education, you might not have a way to come. So the Diversity Visa is just much more open to the world, I think.
And Clara, this was the point you were making before, that there's a kind of a universality to this program.
Yes. But I want us to think a little bit considering the bigger scale. And I have always considered the program also as a powerful geopolitical tool, something that is part of our soft power arsenal. Because as long as people think they may win or their kids may win or their relatives can win, they are invested in this society. They feel that they do care about America's future and America's present. So imagine we have 15 million people applying, and they have relatives, and they have friends, and those people feel invested. So these are millions of people every year who are well wishers for this country, which we're going to lose with just one strike of the pen by saying we are canceling this program. Now, in a moment when we are going to be in a geopolitical rivalry with big countries like China, I want our foreign policy establishment to consider whether we can actually afford it. And if we lose it, what we can put in its stead.
That is indeed an effective argument. Thank you very much, Clara. And thanks to you as well, Julia Gillat, who has studied and written about the Diversity Visa Program at the Migration Policy Institute. So thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, danreen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Al Reynolds and Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Jelton.